Okay, before we get into the show, I'm going to ask you something, and I want you to pretend that you have never heard it before. Really think about it. You get this podcast for free, but it's not free. It's expensive. We need you to help us pay for it. You like what we do, you have to. You're listening right now. So ask yourself right now, why haven't you kicked in lately or ever? If you text OTM to 69866, a really simple form will pop up, and you can send a little something in a matter of seconds. If you go to onthemedia.org/support online, you can pick up a mug or a tote bag while you're at it. The time has come for you to help us with this strange thing that you spend time on. Now spend a few bucks on it. Text OTM to 69866 or go to onthemedia.org/support. Please, and thank you.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This Wednesday, after a long...
Less than 48 hours away from the next debate with the Republican candidate...
Long...
Countdown to showdown, just 14 hours away...
Long...
Getting ready, getting excited, 2 hours, 29 minutes, 2 seconds to go...
Build up. CNN hosted the second round of the GOP primary debates. As moderator Jake Tapper explained at the outset, this wasn't going to be one of those boring debates where the candidates only speak to the moderator and remain, you know... civil. This was going to be real.
A true debate with candidates addressing each other in areas where they differ, where they disagree on policy, on politics, on leadership.
The candidates were more than happy to oblige.
Gave me money was Donald Trump. He wanted casino gambling in Florida.
I didn't want it.
Yes, you did.
Totally false.
You wanted it, and you didn't get it.
I would have
gotten
it.
Because I was opposed to casino gambling before, during, and after. And that's not, I'm not going to be bought by anybody.
I promise, if I wanted it, I would have gotten it.
No way.
Per CNN's wish, civility went south, along with the facts. For instance, in the exchange you just heard, Jeb Bush was right. Donald Trump did unsuccessfully lobby the former Florida governor for the right to build a casino in the Sunshine State. Trump's flat denial was one of the evening's earliest bald-faced lies, but not the last.
Let's remember what the president said. He said the attack that he was going to conduct was going to be a pinprick. Well, the United States military was not built to conduct pinprick attacks.
Marco Rubio was wrong. President Obama specifically said his proposed strike on Syria would not be a pinprick.
I dare Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama to watch these tapes, watch a fully formed fetus on the table, its heart beating, its legs kicking.
Carly Fiorina was wrong. Vox columnist Sarah Cliff watched all 12 hours of unedited footage of the Planned Parenthood videos, and the scene Fiorina describes does not exist.
Most astonishingly, this agreement trusts the Iranians to inspect themselves.
Ted Cruz? Wrong. Rumors of Iranian self-inspection comes primarily from a discredited AP report. If he'd read the actual deal, he'd know it calls for the presence of outside inspectors. When it comes to misdirection, there's so much to choose from. Finally, faced with a broadside from Donald Trump, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, whose own testimony was far from spotless, decided he'd had enough.
Just because he says it doesn't make it true. The facts are the facts. We bounced a $3.6 billion budget deficit.
You're right, Governor Walker. Well, according to PolitiFact, half right. But he was completely right about facts being facts. Still, in presidential debates, the facts have a tendency to give way to their estranged cousin, memorably named by former fake pundit Stephen Colbert.
Truthiness. The truthiness is, anyone can read the news to you. I promise to feel the news at you.
Truthiness rules in political debates because candidates know that the stickiest moments are the ones in which their assertions feel right, even if they are incontestably wrong. And it's hard to blame the candidates entirely for their bad behavior. They probably wouldn't do it if they thought they had to pay for it. And there's the rub. Because in theory, there are moderators on the stage, seasoned journalists, who won't let them get away with it. whereas in reality, this hardly ever happens.
I want to make sure we get that for the record, because it took the president 14 days before he called the attack in Benghazi an act of terror.
Get the transcript.
He did, in fact, sir. So let me call it an act of
terror. Can you say that a little louder, Candy?
He did call it an act of terror.
When CNN's Candy Crawley caught Mitt Romney red-handed in 2012, people took notice. And as Crawley explained on The View the next day, she thought that if she cleared it up, the candidates could move on to more substantive issues.
It did not come to me as like, I'm going to fact check this. It came to me as, could we get past this? Because the point is, this is a semantic thing.
But she was under no delusion about how her flagrant act of journalism would be interpreted.
Look, people are going to look at this through the prism that they look at this through. And
did they ever?
Not so dandy, Candy. After the debate, debating a moderator who went too far. Forget town hall. Did Candy Crawley turn it into a town mall?
She committed an act of journalistic terror or malpractice last night. If there were any journalistic standards, what she did last night would have been the equivalent of blowing up her career like a suicide bomber. But there aren't any journalistic standards anymore.
Oh, the terror of truth. When conducting a foreign policy debate, why not hire moderators with specific knowledge and give them the right to use it? We expect politicians to lie, but we don't expect journalists to keep them honest. Speaking truth to power is so last millennium. So, as we bemoan our dysfunctional politics, let's reserve a groan for the all too often pusillanimous practices of TV journalism. What Candy Crawley did in 2012 shouldn't be outrageous. Certainly no more than the surreal experience of watching grown men and women of both parties lie to each other and to us for hours on end, while moderators who should and do know better egg them on.
Coming up, researchers find that Exxon first seriously researched and then explicitly muddied the waters on climate change.
This is On the Media.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It may not surprise you to learn that ExxonMobil, formerly Exxon, formerly Esso, directed millions of dollars between 1989 and 2007 to dozens of front groups that worked to seed public doubt about the atmospheric impact of burning fossil fuels. And it may not surprise you to learn that Exxon and other companies helped found the group called Global Climate Coalition in 1989, a group that lobbied against emission restrictions until 2002. You've heard that language of denial and doubt from them and other Exxon-funded groups, too.
They're pushing an alarmist agenda that says that humans are the major cause of global warming.
I'm not quite so sure what's so wrong with the environment. I think the environment is fine, considering all the wealth and the air is clean, the water's clean, everything is basically okay.
But this may be a bit of a shock. For a decade in the 70s and 80s, Exxon was at the forefront of scientific research on climate change, and its own scientists were sounding alarms.
There was no questioning that the atmospheric carbon dioxide was increasing, that atmospheric carbon dioxide was going to change the climate in some fashion. The question was how fast, how much, and what kind of impacts would it have.
That was Edward Garvey, a former Exxon climate researcher, in a video produced by Frontline with the Pulitzer Prize-winning website Inside Climate News. This week, that website launched a series documenting Exxon's white hat scientific research and then its sudden shift toward trivializing the growing scientific consensus on climate change. Neela Banerjee, one of the reporters who produced the series for Inside Climate News, describes her aha moment.
One day on a listserv, I got a transcript of a congressional hearing from 1979 that was about climate change. And I thought, oh, you know, isn't this surprising? So just on a lark, maybe because I was procrastinating or something, I looked up Exxon to see if anybody from Exxon was there. And then I found the name of a man. His name was Henry Shaw.
Shaw was leading the company's early efforts into carbon dioxide research. Before learning about him, Inside Climate News believed that the earliest Exxon had looked at the effects of CO2 was in the 1980s.
And that was the sort of thread that started to unravel this. As I started to Google Henry, I found a study that had been done about Exxon outfitting a supertanker with equipment to measure carbon dioxide concentrations in the ocean and in the atmosphere along the supertanker's route from the Gulf of Mexico to the Persian Gulf. And the paper came out in 1982, but the work had been done in the late 70s. We started to pull together names, start to look at places where documents might be, archives and so on, and that's how it all came together.
How far back does the company's interest in CO2 buildup go?
There is a scientist named Jim Black who made a report to Exxon's management committee in July 1977. And the management committee is the top leadership of the company. And he told them about the prevailing science at the time about carbon dioxide, that scientists think it's mainly from the combustion of fossil fuels. And if it keeps up at this rate, it will lead to a warming of the planet. And that could have very grave consequences for human society, things like drought and floods and so on.
To put that in perspective, it wasn't until 1988 that James Hansen of NASA alerted the world in testimony before Congress about the seriousness of this issue. So Exxon.
Right. You know, we were stunned. There's this public Exxon that we know from 1990 onward, sort of skeptical about, you know, how certain the science is, calling for delays. And yet the documents that we've seen and the people we've talked to describe a company where the approach to carbon dioxide and climate change was very neutral, very measured. When one reads Jim Black's text, and you can do it on our website because we've uploaded that document to our first story, it's like any other scientist of the day.
And while the company didn't at the time issue press releases and write in its annual reports about its gathering suspicions and fears about CO2, it also wasn't operating in secret. Its scientists were publishing peer-reviewed papers publicly.
Right. I think a lot of people want to make this appear to be an energy industry parallel of what happened in the tobacco industry. I'm not sure how far that parallel goes because Exxon, at the time that this research was being done, did not suppress any of this. That was actually part of their strategy. They understood that farther down the road, if the science was accurate, which, you know, they thought it would be, that there would be limits placed on emissions from fossil fuels. So their strategy at that time was that we want to have a say in what those limits look like. We want to be taken seriously. And the best way to do that is to do peer-reviewed, irreproachable science. And so they backed conferences on greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. They published in peer-reviewed papers. They, in fact, ended up shelving a major natural gas project, which is still mothballed today because the natural gas was mixed in with a lot of carbon dioxide and they couldn't find a way to get rid of the carbon dioxide and they weren't going to vent it into the atmosphere.
This project off of the coast of Indonesia came at a time when they actually were concerned that supplies were running dangerously low and they still opted not to pursue the Indonesian project on CO2 grounds. It's hard to imagine we're speaking of a major oil company.
I know.
And then something changed.
The documentary evidence and interviews we have so far only extend to 1986. And part of the reason is that Exxon was involved in major layoffs through the 80s because the oil price sank. And a lot of the scientists who were involved in climate research either left or were let go by the mid-80s. And then in 1989, the Global Climate Coalition is formed by fossil fuel companies, and Exxon is one of the leading figures in this effort. So something happened between 86 and 89, and we don't have that information. What we can surmise, though, is that there was a change in management, and the management through the 70s and mid-80s had been looking at alternatives to crude oil. Some of them were carbon-based, like tar sands, but some of them were not. And then you had management come in that were more focused on the core business and thought that Exxon should stick to oil. That was people like Lee Raymond, who went on to become chairman of Exxon.
And Lee Raymond notoriously argued against the Kyoto Protocol and prevailed with the argument that, well, he said, quote, "Let's agree there's a lot we really don't know about how climate will change in the 21st century and beyond," which I guess is nominally true. There is a lot we don't know. But by the time he uttered those words, there was absolute scientific consensus that the temperatures were going up, that ice was melting, that sea levels were rising, and so forth.
Yes. What Exxon did from the late 80s onward was that they hammered away at the uncertainty around various aspects of climate science. And they did not partake in arguments that a lot of deniers use, such as, you know, it's natural cycles or sunspots or anything like that. But instead, they just kept saying, you know, the science is too uncertain for us to make enormous and possibly very expensive shifts in the economy. So the uncertainty became this brake on climate action. The interesting thing is that in the late 70s, early 80s, Exxon scientists saw uncertainty as perfectly normal in evolving science and as an opportunity for research. They actually rebutted climate models that showed that climate change would not be as bad as the prevailing models predicted. And then Exxon basically decided to take an entirely different path. And that's why we call the series The Road Not Taken. If they had stayed on that road, things might be a bit different now, but they didn't.
You went to ExxonMobil. And concerning that original expedition on a supertanker, the spokesman, Richard Kyle, told you that that expedition had nothing to do with trying to figure out the absorption rates of carbon dioxide in the ocean.
You know, people who participated in the project and then the documents said otherwise. We tried to get him to square that, and they declined to do so. I mean, Exxon's approach now is basically not to talk to us. They will not answer questions going forward, though we told them the door is open anytime you want to talk.
Neela, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Neela Banerjee is one of the reporters on the Exxon story for the Pulitzer Prize-winning Inside Climate News. Richard Kyle is ExxonMobil's Senior Advisor for Global Public Affairs. Dick, welcome to OTM.
Glad to be with you, Bob.
You are furious over the Inside Climate News reporting so far. Please explain.
Well, they have accused us of knowing for certain that climate change was a real problem in the early 1980s and then abandoning our research into that to fund climate denial. Nothing could be further from the truth. We have an uninterrupted, continuous 30-year history of researching this important topic. And in the last decade alone, we've spent more than $300 million into both reducing emissions in fossil fuels and researching and exploring alternative energy sources. The reporting is simply flat out wrong.
I don't believe the piece asserted that Exxon had scientific certainty. The piece I read said that Exxon was doing some of the early research about the possibilities, and those possibilities were alarming, but not that there was any scientific certainty about how it all would play out.
Well, the story also accuses us of then abandoning our research into that and getting into funding denial. And in fact, we have an uninterrupted history, 30 years and running, of doing research on this. Our own scientists and researchers have either authored or played significant contributing roles to more than 50 peer-reviewed journals on this topic. And as we know, over time, certainty and knowledge about the risks of climate change and causality became clearer in the late 1990s, for instance, in a way that wasn't possible in the early 1980s, which is the period of time they've chosen to write about. So the story suggests that we knew at a time when nobody did.
As early as the 70s, the National Academy of Sciences was sounding the alarms about the potential for catastrophic warming and melting of ice sheets and so on.
The key word here, though, the key word is potential. There were a range of possibilities people were considering. We and others were completely open to the idea that human activity could cause this, but there simply wasn't any certainty.
You mentioned the $300 million that ExxonMobil has spent over the last decade in pursuit of more science on this subject. In each of the past 2 years, ExxonMobil has earned $33 billion in profits on more than $100 billion of revenues. So $300 million over a decade, 1/3% of corporate revenue, apart from the relatively small sum invested in research. There's also the matter that you're kind of changing the subject, this reporting by Inside Climate News doesn't really concern itself with what ExxonMobil has done lately. It's concerning itself with a very sharp change in corporate behavior and apparently strategy 25 years ago, namely that you dismantled some significant percentage of this research program and, beginning in about 1989, started pouring millions and millions of dollars in the funding of 36 organizations, some of which were transparently industry front groups and some which were right-wing economics advocacy groups that themselves spent decades in various degrees of climate denial.
The reporting here, Bob, recalls a famous saying from the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan: everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but not to their own facts. And the fact of the matter is, we have a continuous and uninterrupted commitment to climate change research.
I can list the names of the 36 organizations, some populated with fringe environmental scientists with quotation marks around it, and some by literally the same personnel who represented big tobacco in the 70s as it lied to the public and its own shareholders about the risks of smoking. And these people were spewing what is very clearly, as phrased by the Royal Academy of Sciences in Britain, disinformation. On the media's interest in all of this is partly the story by Inside Climate News. It's also partly the issue of how proactive Exxon was over a couple of decades in funding these groups and in printing these op-ed ads in the New York Times.
We don't fund those groups. As the science has emerged and become clearer, we're more committed than ever to researching this important topic.
We don't fund them, or we didn't fund them. You got out of the funding business 2009 or some such, but for 20 years before that, you poured...
I'm going to finish my thought here, Bob.
Please clarify this for me. Are not funding or did not fund them?
We are not funding.
Okay, so who cares? It's so simple. If you did fund these different disinformation campaigns to muddy the issues on climate science, the question is, why? Why go from a white hat operation that funds very serious research into a damage control operation that seeks to muddy the issues for the public? Why?
Bob, I reject that narrative. And again, context matters here. There is certainty now around climate change and the causes that didn't exist in the early 1980s. It didn't exist in the late 1980s. It didn't exist in the early 1990s. Once our company was satisfied that not only was it a real and growing and immediate concern, but human activity had something to do with it, we became even more committed to doing the kind of research that I've been describing to you.
You've characterized the Inside Climate News reporting as being flat wrong across a whole area of details. We just had a conversation with them in which they said that they submitted to you personally a long list of specific questions tied to specific facts that they culled from the documentation that was from Exxon's own archives in many cases and peer-reviewed journals. They asked for your response to these questions. They say you declined to provide it.
They came to us at the 11th hour with a long list of questions and in three separate occasions declined to provide documents for our review that were not from publicly available areas. At no time did they produce any of these records to us for our examination.
In the journalism world that I live in, and you are a senior media advisor, so you should be well aware of this, it is not the news organization's responsibility to go to the subject or the source and say, here's what we have. It's its responsibility to ask questions and try to get answers. And they didn't get answers.
In the journalism world I lived in for 20 years before changing careers, if I had the goods on somebody, I would present them with the evidence and give them time to respond. We weren't afforded that opportunity and that courtesy. And my suspicion is the reason we weren't is because they knew if we had a chance to look at these documents and put them in context, they wouldn't have a story. We are committed to science and research around climate change. We have been uninterrupted for 30 years, and their reporting doesn't change that fact.
Uninterrupted, Dick?
I'm sorry?
Because the whole premise of their story is that it was very much interrupted, a very long detour in which Exxon went from a seeker of scientific evidence to a denier of scientific consensus.
That is patently untrue, and it does a great disservice to the scientists and researchers who have been looking into this and other important topics for us without interruption for more than 30 years now.
All right, Dick. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Richard Kyle is Senior Media Advisor for ExxonMobil.
Coming up, Europe and its media keep shuffling their feet on the influx of refugees.
This is On the Media.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Several weeks ago, a photo of a drowned 3-year-old boy named Aylin Kurdi inspired an outpouring of sympathy and support for Europe's refugees. But if some photos are capable of inspiring our best selves, others can just as easily foster hatred, suspicion, and scorn. For example, a pair of photos showing a man from the Middle East in two different poses. On the left, he wears military fatigues and brandishes an automatic weapon. On the right, he sports sunglasses and resort wear. The caption informs us that this man was once an ISIS fighter and is now a, quote, refugee. And therefore we, who were foolish enough to take pity on the thousands in the Middle East displaced by war, are all, quote, suckers. This is a meme now making the rounds on Facebook, amassing anti-refugee smears and shares. It's also completely contrived.
And that image, which showed a sort of before and after shot of a man in Syria and in Europe, featured a guy who had been profiled a week earlier by the Press Association and was actually a former fighter in the Free Syrian Army, who are a secular opposition group in Syria.
Vice writer Philip Kleinfeld was inspired by the BBC's fact-checking of those pictures and set out to find other popular anti-refugee memes.
Perhaps the most ridiculous and absurd was this meme that showed several men being met by border police. And these men, all of them were extremely well-built. They had very large arm muscles. And the text on top of the image said, "I heard we can get free steroids in England. Please help feed this poor, defenseless refugee." It plays on a fairly prevalent expectation people have that refugees are poor and malnourished. It really doesn't matter how large your biceps are or when you ate your last meal when you're fleeing barrel bombs in Syria or the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Where are the women and children is a question that comes up again and again.
I found quite a lot like this. One of the ones I came across, which was really about images being used selectively, was taken from Keleti train station in Budapest. Everyone in the image was a man, and the text said that they were these cowardly people who had left behind their women and children. So I've traced the image to its actual source, found it laying over a video from Keleti train station, watched that video, and of course took lots of screen grabs of women and children. The United Nations statistics on Syrian refugees, which are the largest displaced group, show that the majority are in fact women. Not that it would matter. I mean, male refugees are no less deserving than any others.
There are two ways, I suppose, that these things find their way to the internet. The first is that someone runs across an image, and the image seems to confirm his or her worst fears or prejudices, puts it online, and it takes off. The second possibility is that there are people out there with a mission to seed doubt and fear and hatred and go foraging around the internet for images, knowing full well that these smoking guns they're firing blanks. So which is it in most cases?
I suspect, given that so many of them I found are so obviously fake, that the people that are coming up with these memes are doing so very, very cynically. these groups in the UK, the far right, is very, very balkanized and very, very weak and fractured. And there is definitely a sense that the issue of refugees and migration is something that they can gain political capital from and try and unite behind. So it doesn't surprise me to see these kind of deliberately faked things swirling around the internet, though I don't think necessarily the people that are sharing them are aware of that.
And yet, in order to buy into these memes, we really have to raise our suspension of disbelief. How in this day and age can people do that? Is it just because they're predisposed to hate?
I think so, yeah. These memes are clearly ridiculous and, you know, involve images that are taken out of context and images that have been cropped and so forth. But the actual claims they are making, the idea that these people are migrants making voluntary journeys to improve their standard of living, the idea that they're trying to gain access to our welfare system, the idea that they're possibly jihadists, that they all have smartphones. Again, you know, you can find these things every single day in the mainstream media in the UK. And I think that is why there is a kind of propensity to share them, even though a lot of people know that they shouldn't trust everything they read on the internet.
Which brings me finally to this, Philip. Is this exclusively the behavior of the right? What about the rest of the political continuum?
I think this is what happens when the politically populist thing to do is to be tough on immigration. For years in the UK, we have seen mainstream politicians and media use immigration as this grand explanation for all the problems we face in the country, things like housing and jobs and our way of life. And during the economic crisis, this has seen a real uptick. The result in this case is to construct an entire narrative around economic migrants and this sort of dehumanizing vocabulary that degrades the people that are making these journeys. And I definitely don't think it's something that is limited to far-right Facebook pages. I think it's been bubbling away for years.
Philip, thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks, Bob.
Philip Kleinfeld is a writer for Vice.
This week in Brussels, EU ministers gathered to forge a cohesive response to the hundreds of thousands of refugees seeking asylum in Europe. It didn't go so well.
The European Union has failed to reach an agreement on a migrant resettlement plan. Leaders held
Austria, Slovakia, the Netherlands, they've all said they would bring border checks back. Germany has already reimposed border controls.
It really kind of calls into question one of the proudest achievements of the European Union thus far, which is that everyone can move freely within the borders of the 28 countries.
With EU paralysis and a newly confounding patchwork of border controls, streams of refugees find themselves stalled across the Balkan Peninsula as they seek passage to Austria and Germany. I was in Austria last week to speak at a conference, but I spent a morning at Vienna's Western train station for weeks of port of call for refugees en route from Hungary to Germany and points north. The station was filled with refugees, well-dressed and ragged, children, infants, the very old, all exhausted.
Can you tell me your name?
Mohammed.
Where were you coming from?
I am coming from Syria.
And then where did you go?
To Turkey and Greek and Macedonia and Serbia and Hungary. It's very, very, very hard. Police Macedonia kicked me and Hungary and Austria, and we won't go to Germany. Our search for life, we are people, we are not animals.
How did you hear that Germany was a good place?
Yeah, very good place.
How do you know?
Angela Merkel.
Angela Merkel.
Yeah, I see Angela Merkel in the television. My friend tell me to go to Germany. We are coming.
Thank you, Mohammed.
Thank you.
Can you tell me your name?
Mustafa.
You're from Iraq. Where have you been getting your information?
Information? Frankly, from Facebook. All people, if they want to give information for other people, they're directly on Facebook.
And there were volunteers. Behind one table, several young men served a throng of refugees who were urgently seeking their particular help.
We can help them set up the Wi-Fi. A lot of them only want to have an internet connection because they use things like WhatsApp and Viber to call home. Then sometimes the Wi-Fi is not enough because they, okay, they travel, then they need 3G internet. What we can do, we can help them buy SIM cards for about 20 euros. So we get a translator, grab them. As you can see here, we have like 5-6 people. We group them together, go to the tobacco, buy SIM cards together, buy coupons, and I set it up for them so they can use the internet. And that's what I do. So I'm like a tech guy. Everybody tries to chip in where they can, and that's what I can do best.
How long have you been coming here?
I've been coming here for the last 3 days.
And how long do you stay?
I will be here until nobody needs me no more. That's what I do. Most of them just want to phone home.
A woman from a tea service, I guess, inside the station has just come out with a tray full of hot tea for the refugees. Not a single person I've spoken to seems to know or even care what the mainstream media or the political parties that they reflect say about them. All they care about is logistics and how they can move on. It's times like these, when covering a meta subject like the media seems particularly irrelevant. But these narratives will come to haunt them later. Vienna-based journalist Alison Langley has been reading the local press, and she says all but one extremist tabloid is reflecting what she's found most Austrians feel, a deep sense of sympathy.
There was just an article in today's paper, for instance. It started off with, you know, studies show that if you help, you feel good about yourselves. The whole story was about how companies have come out and started donating, and they're letting employees take help time to go and volunteer, and not just at train stations and not just at the border town, but also in the homes where people are being brought. Overwhelmingly, the feeling that I'm getting is that everyone's really shocked at how helpful that everyone's been, because this isn't what everyone expects from Austrians.
Michael Freund is a professor in media communications at Webster University in Vienna and an editor at Der Standard, one of Vienna's leading independent papers. I asked him to compare the coverage of the tabloid press in Austria with Germany's. He said the Austrian tabs, even the conservative ones, take a positive stance on the issue, but with an emphasis on national competence and generosity.
Interestingly enough, they are not quite sure whether to call them refugees or asylum seekers or migrants. They feature mostly the Austrian military and the Austrian police doing a good job and helicopters and doing this, doing that, and they're like the heroes. The migrants, they're not even treated in a hostile way, but they're like always masses. There are photographs of them like by the hundreds, and they have no names, they have no profession, they have no story, nothing. And the Bild-Zeitung, the German tabloid, is the most forthcoming. They are the ones who actually have human interest stories about kids that come, and they're very proud. You come to us, you know, they're like assuming somewhat paternalistic, but very forthcoming and welcoming attitude in their editorials and in their reporting. They give them names, they give them stories, quite unusual for a tabloid the size and the ideology of Bild-Zeitung.
But in the last few days, you sense a shift in the take of the Austrian tabloids.
Very recently, they had a headline, "Are there terrorists among the refugees?" You know, in huge, bold letters, which is about as intelligent as asking, are there killers among the Austrians? Yes, of course, if there are hundreds of thousands of people, there may be some bad apples. It's kind of the old fear-mongering thing that's coming up again. It may be the result of too much positive reporting, too many nice human interest stories, so maybe there's now time for a somewhat more belligerent type of reporting. There are going to be regional elections in about a month. Interestingly enough, the right-wing party is very quiet right now. They may be waiting for harvesting the dissenting feelings.
Alison Langley suggests it will be a fruitful harvest.
I'm going to go out on a limb and maybe make a prediction that you're going to see an increase in support for the far right.
Why?
When I go out and I talk to the Austrians who are helping, they will tell me, almost every single one of them, they're there because they are not seeing political leadership. In the spring, refugees were still coming in, even before the rest of the world knew it, and they were sleeping in tents. people were looking at this and saying, how can it be that in one of the wealthiest countries in the world, we're forcing people who are fleeing war to sleep in tents? In June, there were no more beds, so they were sleeping out in the open on the grass. This is what Austrians were seeing. They were so disgusted, they just went down in their cars, handing out tents, handing out clothes, handing out food. They're so upset and so disenfranchised from the established parties. They're telling me that they're not going to vote. Who do I vote for? So that leaves then the people who are fearful of this influx of refugees. They are more likely to vote. So late September, we're going to see Upper Austria voting, and the Gallup poll has already predicting a 10% increase of support for the far-right party.
Have you been looking more broadly towards Hungary? Give me a sense of what's going on there.
The press in Hungary is strongly, strongly controlled by Viktor Orban's party. So you're not going to see anybody straying very far from the party line. That the refugees are going to destroy the Christian way of life of Europe. Not all of them are fleeing war and strife. A large part of them are economic migrants being opportunistic. So that's what you're seeing in the mainstream press in Hungary. However, this is starting to change on social media. They're starting to look at what Austria is doing because there's always this historical connection between Austria and Hungary. And I'm just now starting to see people saying, I am ashamed. On September 9th, I don't know if you saw it, there was video footage of a far-right television station producer who tripped one of the refugees. He was a father holding his daughter, and she stuck her foot out, and he and the daughter fell. That just went viral over Facebook. They also showed her accidentally stepping on a little four-year-old girl. It was such an inexcusable act of unkindness. It woke up a lot of people, and I think it took that. They had to fire her, and she has now apologized, saying that the video was taken out of context and that she's actually a very nice person. One of the other reasons why you're seeing in Germany and in Austria, especially you're seeing young people coming out and helping, is they're so done with the Second World War, and they are so done with people trying to equate Austria and Germany with the sins of their fathers. They want to be able to say, I'm from Germany, and not have someone say, oh, are they all full of Nazis? And make some Nazi joke. This is their way of saying, that's not me. You're seeing that a lot in the press too. You know, you're not seeing any references to the World War, but you're really seeing people are proud. They are proud to be German again. They're proud to be Austrian again. That's what the press is reflecting.
Christian Hoffmann, deputy head of Der Spiegel in Berlin, agrees that the German coverage of the migration crisis has been sympathetic to the refugees' plight, with even right-leaning tabloids like Bild publishing emotional appeals to the German public to be compassionate and helpful. It's a reflection of a society altogether different economically and demographically from the one 20 years ago in which Der Spiegel rebuffed refugees with the headline, Das Boot ist voll. The boat is full.
Exactly. And that was also due to the economic situation. In the 90s, we've had a high unemployment, which we don't have now. On the contrary, because Germans are not having enough children, we really need migration. And then there's this feeling that Germany is in great shape economically, and we have been spared of a lot of negative developments that other countries in Europe have seen. So there is a certain amount of gratefulness, of thankfulness, which Germans feel that they could pass on to others. And also I think that we have a very strong elderly generation of people who go on pension in their 60s, who are healthy, fit, and quite well off.
They're bored.
Yeah, they're looking for something meaningful for them to do in life. So that's also why they engage.
How much does the context of the Second World War play into this?
People might not be conscious of it. They might not even agree to it when you speak about it. But I think that, you know, for Germans to be the morally good nation, to do something that is right and that is respected everywhere is really a new feeling. Let's take the decision of Merkel to open the borders. That was taken at a point when she was in contact with the Hungarian president, with Orban, and the Austrian Prime Minister Faymann, and they were telling her about these refugees walking in the streets towards the German border. And this is very essentially a picture that reminds Germans of the death walks at the end of World War II, when Nazis were driving the prisoners out of concentration camps, and they were dying while they were walking, and they were so weak. And that was essentially what Austrian Prime Minister was telling Merkel, is that, you know, we will have scenes of people breaking down while they are walking towards Germany. It's very clear that these pictures have a historical background.
Piles of belongings, piles of clothes. There's a resonance there.
Exactly. And the fences that we see in Hungary, it was the fences on the Hungarian border that were open, and it started the process of German reunification. The trains coming from Hungary with East Germans to West Germany. It was the beginning of the brightest part of German history in the last century. But the trains in Germany are always also the trains of Jews going to concentration camps and going into their death. We've always felt we've never got rid of the shame of our history. So I think it really still feels somewhat strange for Germans to be on the good side of history.
There's been a lot of soul-searching in Der Spiegel's coverage. I mean, a recent issue had two covers, one that was dark and sinister with a burning house, and the other was bright with a happy crowd flying balloons. And in the piece was the quote, "Which Germany will prevail? The Germany of racist chants from the roadside? The Germany of rioters and drunken rock throwers? Dark Germany, as President Joachim Gauck calls it? Or will it be the new bright Germany?"
Well, it shows that Germany is still unsure about its identity. I feel that more mature nations, like maybe Great Britain, who are more sure of who they are, wouldn't go to the extremes that Germany is seeing at the moment. So, as you said, we are doing soul searching and still asking the question, who are we?
So now that border controls have been reapplied, slowing the flow, are some of the tabloids like Bild Zeitung back to its old stance? Or is the coverage still mostly positive?
It is more neutral. There are stories about the difficulties of taking these people in, of handling the influx. And Bild even ran an interview with Orban, the Hungarian president, who was extremely critical of what Merkel has done and refuses to take in refugees. So the coverage is more diverse, but it hasn't turned in a way that it's become negative.
Has the government been trying to shape the coverage in any way?
What I feel uneasy about is that during last week, when I've been in several background meetings with politicians, I heard a tone of trying to influence coverage by making a moral point, by appealing to the moral of journalists and sort of accusing those who point to the difficulties of actually being xenophobic or playing into the hands of xenophobes.
You've had to confront and process, as a reporter, a story that's been floating around on the margins practically your whole professional life, I assume. Have you discovered anything within yourself writing about this issue?
You know, I've covered Russia for 5 years in the 90s, and I've covered the Middle East living in Tehran, in Iran. So I'm very much used to a view that is not European, and it has taught me actually to be very realistic. That's why I've been reluctant from the beginning to Merkel's gesture of idealism. I think we must give room to those who are afraid. We can't silence them by saying you shouldn't have these doubts because it's immoral. I'm always suspicious when you don't want to see the dark side or when you just tell the dark side to be silent.
On the other hand, you have a lot of old people whose social security needs to be paid and who need a purpose in life.
Yes, very much so, very much so. And I see it, you know, in so many people around me, my parents, my children, who say, Mommy, can we do something for refugees? You know, the good thing about it is that it is really about something. You know, so many times when you cover politics, it's about useless fights and this bubble of politics and media. And here we have a topic that is real and it concerns almost everyone, and that feels good.
Christiane, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Christiane Hoffmann is deputy head of Der Spiegel in Berlin.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Sam Dingman. We had more help from Alex Friedland, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon.
And we extend our thanks to Webster University in Vienna. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.